Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with increasing concern at the White House and among the Joint Chiefs that Israel is preparing to take military action against Iran in spite of US objections. We will look into Israeli covert activity that harms US interests with an historian specializing in intelligence, Mark Perry. He has an article at Foreign Policy, False Flag, that reveals how Mossad agents posed as CIA officers to recruit terrorists who killed Iranian soldiers and civilians. Then finally, we'll be joined by Thomas Frank, the author of the new book, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, which examines how the worst economy since the 1930s that crashed under George W. Bush brought about a revival of conservatism. Joining us now is Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military, foreign affairs, and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. He is the recipient of both the 1995 National Jewish Book Award and the prestigious Project Censured Award. He has an article at Foreign Policy, False Flag, which reveals a series of CIA memos that describe how Israeli Mossad agents posed as American spies to recruit members of the terrorist organization Jundala to fight their covert war against Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Perry.
It's good to be here.
And the Wall Street Journal are reporting that U.S. defense leaders are increasingly concerned that Israel is preparing to take military action against Iran over U.S. objections. President Obama spoke by telephone on Thursday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Martin Dempsey, is going over to Israel to meet with top military officials this week. And I have to add to that list the recent condemnation of the bombing or the killing of the Iranian scientist by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who went out of her way to say the United States had nothing to do with it. So give me your assessment of friction, apparent friction, both public and behind the scenes between these two allies.
Well, I think we're in a very delicate situation internationally. Israel is very fearful that Iran poses an existential threat. On the other hand, it's very clear to me in talking to my contacts here in Washington, especially in the military, that we do not want a conflict. The United States and Israel are allies, but as is the case with all alliances, there's arguments, internal arguments, sometimes very serious ones, and we're in that period now where Israel wants to move quickly, feels threatened. We are arguing they're not threatened. We need sanctions to work and diplomacy to work, and we don't see particularly eye to eye on this.
Well, my understanding is that there have been talks going on between high-level State Department officials in Turkey. In other words, following the president's signature on New Year's Eve of the National Defense Authorization Act that ramps up sanctions against Iran, that was largely pushed through by Republicans, but it was overwhelmingly supported. And the president wanted some flexibility, particularly because he was afraid that pushing Iran to the wall would raise the price of gasoline in an election year. So it seems like both sides are trying to walk back a little bit from, and the Iranians, of course, have been quite provocative with their exercises in the Straits of Hormuz and their statements about closing them. My understanding is that these meetings have been taking place in Turkey, where they're walking back. Larijani, the head of the speaker, who's close to the supreme leader, showed up at these meetings. And coinciding with that was the killing of the Iranian scientist, which is perhaps explains Hillary Clinton's anger, and there's a feeling that maybe the Israelis were trying to scuttle diplomacy. What's your reading on that?
Yeah, there is a widespread feeling in Washington that the Israelis are moving too quickly and trying to scuttle diplomacy. I don't have the same amount of confidence as a lot of people here in town that these talks or purported talks in Turkey are going to lead anywhere. It's always been difficult for the United States talk to the Iranians, and that's not all on us. The Iranians have shown some hesitation to talk, and there's at least presumptive evidence that they're moving forward on some kind of a nuclear program, perhaps not yet a nuclear weapon, which scares the Israelis. Listen, I come back to the kind of the bottom line here, which is the United States is doing everything it can to reach some kind of an accommodation short of war. The president is worried about gas prices, but he's also worried that, as we all know, once a war starts, you never know where it's going to end. It's going to cost American lives in all probability and Israeli lives. And there's no guarantee here that we're going to win a war. We thought that in Iraq, and it went on for 7 years. We don't want to go through that experience again. Our economy is not in shape to take this kind of a confrontation. I think that there's all kinds of efforts being made here to step back from the brink on the part of the United States and Iran. That's not so clear with Israel.
So what about a possibility, and I don't mean to be conspiratorial, Mark Perry, but there have been incidents in recent history during an election year where the government that wants to get into power manipulates things behind the scenes. Henry Kissinger met with Madam Chiang Kai-shek, who persuaded the South Vietnamese to walk out of peace talks, which clearly, had they made a deal to end the Vietnam War under Johnson, would have helped the election of Humphrey, and instead Nixon was elected, and there was this so-called October surprise scenario where Bill Casey supposedly made some contacts with Iranians. That was never thoroughly proven. However, there was an awful lot of smoke, if not fire. Is it possible that Netanyahu, who was very close to the Republicans, and after all, they were the ones who pushed through this National Defense Authorization Act, although the Democrats did sign it, of course. Is there any possibility that there could be some meddling in this election to help a Romney?
Well, I don't mean to be conspiratorial either. What you have just laid out is a very plausible scenario. The other plausible scenario, however, seems to contradict it, that wars are always good for incumbent presidents who are seen to be strong and resolute, and in this case, Mr. Obama would be seen to be pro-Israeli. I think when you sit down to do these calculations, if you're political leaders and you don't know how things are going to turn out, it seems more plausible to me that the calculation would be, let's not do anything. We're going to win this election anyway, Mr. Obama would say. And why do that? And if you're president of the United States and you're sitting in the White House and you're talking about a regional conflict and the deaths of American men and women in combat.
And the price of gas getting up to $10 a gallon.
Price of gas getting up to $10. I think that your political calculations on your list of important things to do is very, very, it might not even be on the list. Preventing war might be number one on the list if you're Barack Obama. And it might be number one on the list if you're Mitt Romney, because he knows a war conducted by an incumbent president elects and reelects an incumbent president, as was the case with John Kerry and George Bush in that election. When was it? 2004.
Right. Let's get into your article, Mark Perry. This is a pretty shocking story, and your sources in the CIA, a couple of whom are still in there and several who were in there recently, are pretty mad at the Israelis. I mean, they are fuming simply because it's okay if the Israelis want to, this is quoting them, it's okay if the Israelis want to shed blood, but it would help a lot if it was their blood and not ours. And there are a lot of people now, important people in Washington, who think that the Israelis are supposed to be a strategic asset. Well, guess what? There's a lot of people now who think that's just not true. So give me a sense of this civil war.
Shocking story, and it has gotten a lot of attention. And in 250 words or less, let me kind of lay it out. It's that in the 2007 and 2008 period, Israeli Mossad operatives recruited the terrorist group Jandullah, which is an anti-Iranian terrorist group, to conduct operations against Iran. That's okay if Israel wants to do that. But what they did was the Israeli Mossad agents posed as CIA officers. In one case, they used U.S. passports and U.S. money in their meetings with Jundala operatives. The CIA found out about it, wrote a report on it, went to the top of the agency, went into the White House, and the president was really angered about it.
George W. Bush.
But in the end, probably because of bureaucratic inertia, did nothing. When Obama came into office, he immediately put Jundala on the foreign terrorist organizations list and the State Department list. That's the sum of the story. It has caused the fact that Israeli Mossad officers were posing as CIA officers, which is a red line for the United States. We just don't want them to do that. The fact that they did that has a tendency to draw us into their conflict. And it paints us with a brush of supporting a foreign terrorist organization, which our government doesn't do. Now, you can agree or disagree with our government's tactics in sending drones into Pakistan, for instance, but at least we're fighting terrorism, not supporting terrorism. The Jundala operation that Israel conducted that was going to paint us into a corner as a state supporter of terrorism, which was just an absolute red line that no president would ever approve of or look on with any sympathy whatsoever. And Bush was really angry about it, but as I say, nothing was done then.
Well, but isn't it even worse, in a sense, in terms of spycraft and relations with allies, that these meetings with the Mossad officers posing as CIA operatives with the Jundala officials took place in London?
One of them that we know of took place in London, but that's absolutely right. You're absolutely right. The other took, there was at least one in Casablanca in Morocco, two or three in Pakistan, one purportedly in Afghanistan, well, that's not clear. They were monitored by us. We learned about them through a complaint from the London CIA station in London. It's clear to me that we intervened with the Pakistanis to arrest and to turn over to Iran the head of Jundala, who was then executed. It's a hell of a story, to be honest with you. And it took me 18 months to write, but it's a very intriguing story of a byplay between Israel and the United States that the public doesn't often see.
And this obviously would have caused frictions with Pakistani officials and the U.S. and the military and the ISI, because Jundala are a radical Sunni group killing Shiites. And, of course, this goes on all the time in Pakistan. It just happened today with a bombing at a Shiite shrine. What was the fallout between the U.S. and the ISI? Because the Iranians were blaming the Pakistanis, weren't they?
Yes, they were. That's exactly right. There was a real problem between the United States and Pakistan, because Pakistan's question to us was, why are you supporting a terrorist group that's operating on our soil? And it caused some real discomfort in the United States, because we were at the time, during the Bush administration, trying to build a very strong relationship with Pakistan. And the answer from the Bush administration was, we don't have anything to do with this. This is not ours. And when Pakistan arrested the head of Jundala and was going to turn him over to Iran, they kind of questioned us as to whether that was okay to do, and we had no objections. We sided with Pakistan, basically, and against Israel on this. It caused a lot of problems. And these kinds of operations, these false flag operations, where intelligence officers pose as belonging to a different country, are extremely dangerous and can draw countries like the United States into conflicts that we don't want. Thankfully, it didn't come close to that then during the Bush administration. But you have to wonder, you know, in the most recent assassination of the Iranian scientists, the Iranians automatically blamed the United States. And frankly, we didn't have anything to do with that. I believe Leon Panetta and Hillary Clinton are absolutely right. We condemned the killing, and we said in public and very strongly, as you pointed out in your introduction of me, we objected very strongly to this and condemned it.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with Mark Perry. Thank you.
take piano painting, lock it up and leave? Do you really think you can just put it in a safe behind a painting, lock it up and leave? Walk away now, and you're gonna start a war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. So in your article, Mark Perry, again, at Foreign Policy, False Flag, that you say that when Bush found out about that Mossad agents were posing as CIA agents to recruit Jindallah terrorists and implicate the U.S. in terrorism and assassination, which is illegal, there was a huge rift in the White House between, I guess, the neocons in Dick Cheney's National Security Council were opposed, or the real National Security Council under Bush that was even smaller than Dick Cheney's National Security Council. There was a battle between those two.
Yeah, let me add a little bit of a caveat here, and it's going to be surprising to you as it was to me. There was a rift in the White House. On the one side were those supporters of Israel who argued, well, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And those who said, on the other side, who said, absolutely not. We cannot be seen to support a terrorist organization. We don't care what Israel does. Now, the guy who was really, my information is that some of the people that we might believe are neocons and have been painted as neocons, at least some of them came over to the side of, we can't participate in this, no matter what Israel does. There was even a split in the neoconservative community inside the national security establishment about this, because while they support Israel, and by the way, President Bush, as you know, was one of the strongest supporters of Israel we've ever had in this country as president, there was a line that was crossed here. It's one thing to be supportive and pro-Israel, and it's another thing to endorse an operation that harms your own country. And some very key neoconservatives were on the other side of this argument, arguing we can't allow Israel to do this. So, you know, while the details of who those people were in the White House on either side of the argument is not in the article, because I just can't nail it totally, it's very clear to me that there were splits in the neoconservative community also.
So, Mark Perry, and of course, the U.S. still, there's still support, is there not, for MEC, the Mujahideen al-Haq? That's a lot of that's come from the neoconservative quarters.
Absolutely right. And I think it's embarrassing that former national security officials and neoconservatives in this country would show up at a conference of the Mujahideen al-Khalq, which is on the foreign terrorist organization list and is a terrorist organization, that Americans would seem to be associated with this, and important Americans, I think is an embarrassment to this country and contradicts what we've been trying to do in the war on terrorism. If I had any kind of influence at all, I'd stand up and condemn them. But, what we need are people in the administration who will say this is unacceptable and not allowed. But there's no question, the MEK, a notorious anti-Iranian terrorist organization, is supported by some very prominent neoconservatives and even by some mainstream, albeit pro-Israel, conservatives in the country. And as I say, it's an embarrassment.
So, Mark Perry, just back to Israel's point of view, which is that they feel that Tehran has crossed an Israeli red line with their announcement they're going to be enriching uranium to 20% at this underground nuclear facility near the holy city of Qom. The Russians even came out against it, by the way. What's happening now in Israel indicates that Israel is preparing. There's a big exercise going on now called Austere Challenge 12 with the U.S. and Israel, apparently designed to intercept a barrage of Hezbollah missiles that they expect in terms of asymmetrical warfare. If Israel would attack Iran, Iran would use Hezbollah to retaliate against Israel. They're shutting down the Dimona nuclear reactor, which, by the way, during the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein fired several salvos of Scud missiles at Dimona. And the U.S. apparently is making contingency plans to fortify the embassy in Baghdad, which they feel that Iranian-backed militias in Iraq could retaliate against.
Yes, I I visit the Middle East often, and I visit Israel often. And the last time I was there, I sat and talked with several, let me describe them as policymakers, very senior. And I think that we have to acknowledge Israel's concerns here. We can't just, toss them off as irrational. It's not. If you're the Prime Minister of Israel and you're sitting in your office in Jerusalem, you view yourself as kind of not just the defender of Israel and the insurer of its future existence, but as they feel, as kind of the political leader of the Jewish people. And if you feel, considering history here very carefully, if you feel that your country's existence is in danger and that not just Israel but the Jewish people are about to be attacked, it puts you in a very different kind of mindset. And I think that understanding that and acknowledging it has to make us acknowledge that Israel does feel threatened and something must be done. The question is, what? And it is not the case that a war is necessarily the best thing that can happen here, despite Israel's legitimate, I think, security concerns. They're extremely worried, and their worries can't be passed off. The question for us, and I think the attempt by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs in his visit to Israel this coming week will be, listen, we have your back, but don't do anything precipitous. Let's try to solve this some other way and give it a little bit more time. We're not ignoring your concerns at all, but war is not always the best option, and we're not at that point yet. I think that's the message he's taking to Israel.
Well, I think going back, Mark Perry, to the NDAA, it's pretty clear that came about, at least my assumption is that in many ways that came about, again, pushed by largely by Senators McCain and Lindsey Graham, but voted for by a vast majority of Democrats, which would indicate, I think, the power of the Israeli lobby, that that Israel was basically using leverage of a threat to attack Iran as a way to get these stronger sanctions. So it seems extraordinary to me that the Israelis are actually getting what they wanted, and that's still not good enough for them.
Well, I think that your supposition as a supposition is correct. The Israel lobby is very strong, and the inclination of the Senate and the Congress in general is to support Israel unflinchingly. What's interesting about the current situation is that while the Congress might be that way, if you go into the policymaking establishment in the United States, that is to say, people who aren't elected but have been in their intelligence or defense jobs for 30 years and know this stuff well, Israel is not that deeply supported. There's a real rift inside of our own government where the Congress is, let's go, Israel's threatened, and the CIA, Defense Department, and State Department are saying, let's pull back the horses here. We're galloping a little bit too fast. There is that dynamic that we have to take into account.
What is your sense then how the Obama administration is going to kind of handle this, because it's got to be a nightmare for them that they apparently still have not gotten assurances out of Israel that they won't attack. He tried to water down the NDAA, giving him some flexibility about the price of oil. Apparently, the U.S. on the one hand, I mean, it appears that we're doing a two-track thing. Tim Geithner's running around the world trying to get customers of Iranian oil to stop buying it, and apparently succeeded in getting the Japanese to stop buying it. They failed with the Indians. I don't know how they're doing with the South Koreans, and the Chinese want no part of it. So give us a sense of is that just the two-track that, in order to make the sanctions work, in order to get diplomacy, you have to put the screws on with sanctions?
Yeah, well, two tracks is right. I think that there's a, in this sense, we're preparing for the worst, but we're working hard to prevent it. And we're protecting ourselves on these two tracks by running around the world getting support for sanctions at the same time that we're running around the world making sure that everyone has enough supply of oil in case the worst case happens. I wish I had a crystal ball, and I keep trying to find a historical metaphor that will explain very simply the current time, and everyone keeps saying August 1914, and I say no. In August 1914, all these young men in Europe were happy to go to the recruiting stations to fight a war. That's not true now. Nobody really wants this. And what is disturbing is that despite no one really wanting this, it keeps creeping closer and closer. And I think that this is what really frightens the Obama administration and why we're seeing these high-level delegations traveling into the Middle East to try to calm everything down. And I think that the current situation will turn on whether those delegations are successful in calming fears and pulling back. They might not be, in which case, sadly and tragically, we would have a war.
Well, clearly, I mean, just in closing, Mark, isn't there fairly obvious evidence that the Republicans are stepping over each other, presidential candidates? They're almost stepping over each other to be the first to bomb Iran. And is that just, their, way to have a more robust, manly foreign policy, if you will? Or do they know something? In other words, are they...
I think it's funny. I'm always shocked, and I'm not a naive person, but I'm always shocked when it seems that every Republican candidate, with the exception of Ron Paul, seems intent at some point during any debate or public talk to say how much they like Israel. I would have thought that it would be a requirement for a candidate for president to love their own country, and to say that. I think for the Republican candidates, it's funding, because there's a lot of pro-Israel money, and because they feel that they can chip away at the Jewish American vote that has traditionally gone for the Democrats and especially for Obama. I don't think they can do that, but that's certainly one of their strategies. To more directly answer your questions and to confirm, I think, what is clearly your own feelings, it's irresponsible to do it, to bang the table and say, let's have a war, on the assumption that somehow you're going to win it and it's not going to cost very much. That might not be the case. And this will come back to haunt people if there is a war. People will stand up in this country and say, what are our political leaders doing? We had a war in Iraq. We're having one in Afghanistan. They didn't turn out well. They're not turning out well. And now we had another one. I think it's playing with fire, and I think it's very dangerous.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Mark Perry.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. He's a recipient of both the 1995 National Jewish Book Award and the prestigious Project Censored Award. He has an article at Foreign Policy, False Flag, which reveals a series of CIA memos that describe how Israeli Mossad agents posing as American spies recruited members of the terrorist organization Jundallah to fight their covert war against Iran. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment straight to Thomas Frank, the author of the new book, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right.
Give me, don't ask what for. Give me, I
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Frank, the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and most recently, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. He's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal and is the founding editor of The Baffler and a monthly columnist for Harper's. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Frank.
It's great to be here.
And your new book is a very welcome, warning, clarion call here that it deals with this extraordinary paradox, which has sort of troubled me for some time, and I've never been able to find a real answer to it. And I guess it goes back to when Obama first came in, the left, which would normally be the constituency that were outraged at what happened over the Wall Street crash and the subsequent bailout, they did nothing, while the far right, the Tea Party, stole all of that anger and disgust at what happened on Wall Street and ran with it and formed the Tea Party and took over the Congress in 2010.
That's exactly right. That's the book, man. That's what it's about. About how, you know, how the left completely missed this moment, and it was instead captured. Public anger was just completely swiped by the right after the financial crisis and the bailouts. I mean, this is stuff that should have been, I often say, a T-ball moment for the left, you know? It should have been an easy home run.
Well, but there was a signal, though, and I don't mean to discount all, you know, ideological credibility with the right, and particularly with the Tea Party, who I think quite fairly have been captured by political pros like Karl Rove and Dick Armey, and funded by the Kochs. So arguably that is a astroturf movement, although perhaps it did start out as a grassroots movement. But I think what's pretty clear on the record was that the first top vote for the bailout of Wall Street, it was the Republicans who overwhelmingly rejected that bailout.
That's right. Now, my view is that was not their alternative. Was not very responsible. I mean, what they were proposing we do instead would have been, you know, I actually went back and looked this up, and it would have been like this, you know, a disaster in like eight different ways. But at least they had, you know, they were able to come out of that debate with this morally sound position that they were against the bailouts. And that was, you know, that's been their ace in the hole ever since. They opposed it. Now, they opposed it. The grounds they opposed it on were these sort of, you know, that bailouts are a violation of free market principle and government should never get involved in the private sector and, you know, and that sort of thing. And that's not the same reason that I, you know, oppose the bailouts. But nevertheless, you know, they came across in the early days and still come across today as, you know, as they're in the right place morally on that issue.
So I guess the argument then would be, Thomas Frank, that at that point was when the Democrats and their new leader, President Obama, should have explained why they have to drink this poison.
Exactly. And they never really did a very good job of that, especially with the bailouts. You know, it was the bailouts, of course, were first instituted, you know, under George Bush and Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, both of them conservative Republicans. And when President Obama got in, he accepted their bailout strategy and vowed to continue it, and did. He basically accepted it completely. Made it his own policy, you know, took ownership of it. And he, I think, thought that this was very high-minded and statesmanlike and bipartisan. And, you know, even though it was a tough, you know, it was an unpopular thing to do and it was an ugly situation, you know, it was, of course, it was very popular with the banks. The people that funded President Obama's presidential campaign last time around. It was very popular with them, but with the public, it was despised. And I don't think that he or his people ever really figured that the Republicans would be, or that anybody, you know, on the right would be able to use this issue against him, because the bailouts had obviously been started by George W. Bush. And were they ever surprised, you know, when the right came along and said, oh, George W. Bush, not a real conservative. It turned out to be the easiest thing in the world for them. They just pitched George Bush overboard, took about 10 big paces to the right, you know, just kept moving to the right and said, you know, we've got to double down in our commitment to free market theory, you know, to having some kind of pure free market regime. And then, you know, you wouldn't have things like bailouts. And all of this, of course, and this is what makes it so deeply ironic, the kind of thing that just makes you want to, you know, bang your head on the table. They did all this after this financial crisis that had been brought on by deregulation and getting government out of the picture and letting the banks do just whatever they want. And now they're you know, you look at their presidential campaigns, you know, there's in the primary states, you know, these guys are all swearing to outdo one another with how much they're going to deregulate and how they're going to, you know, how much they're going to whittle back the regulatory state. It's amazing.
Just on trying to figure out why Obama dropped the ball on this. My understanding is, one, you mentioned it, Thomas Frank, that he took a lot of money from Wall Street. I believe in some of the meetings with the Wall Street bankers, Obama said, look, I'm the only guy between you and an angry mob. A lot of good that appears to have done him. Do you think that had Obama instituted a kind of PCORA-like commission that FDR did and campaigned against these giant banks from day one, it'd be a different situation today?
It definitely would be. By the way, they did do an investigation of the financial crisis. This is it wasn't Obama. It was Congress that did it. But what he could have done differently, and this is something that, by the way, I didn't even know about at the time when all the bailouts were going on in 2008 and 2009, and I didn't figure this out until I did the research for Pity the Billionaire, and I was digging back, and, you know, I wanted to look up the history of bailouts because I wanted to see if this had ever been, you know, how this had been done in the past and how people had reacted. And sure enough, it turns out that our government bailed out banks big time in the 1930s. And the program started under Herbert Hoover, and it was extremely unpopular for the very same reason that bailouts were unpopular this time around. I mean, there was rampant cronyism. I mean, it was sort of extreme. What happened was Hoover appointed the guy who had been vice president under Calvin Coolidge to run his bailout agency. Okay, so he's running the bailout agency, and then all of a sudden he quit, went back to Chicago, his hometown, and resumed presidency of a local bank there and immediately demanded a bailout. And he got it, right? And the public was furious. You know, this is the guy that was the head of the bailout agency. It was getting bailed out. You know, and they were and this is while, you know, of course, people were starving and there was, you know, people were, you know, unemployment was sky high, and I believe the teachers in Chicago at that time hadn't been paid for 2 years or something like that. No, it's something crazy like that. And Franklin Roosevelt, far from saying, oh, let's do the statesmanlike thing and just accept Herbert Hoover's bailout strategy, he did the opposite. He was highly critical of it. You know, and he's for reasons that are very obvious today, because it was cronyism, because it was, you know, it was helping out the people at the top, the Wall Street banks, rather than the people who needed it most. You know, it was leaving Wall Street in charge of the economy, all of those things. And he kept doing bailouts when he was president, but he did it in a very different way. For example, when they bailed out a big bank, they would often fire the management, you know, and for really good reason. If a bank requires a bailout, you know, something has gone wrong. You get rid of these guys. We never do that now. He would bail out. He would cap executive, you know, salaries. You know, no bonuses like you had at AIG. No bonuses for the perps. You know. And, you know, just right down the line. But they took great pains to let the public know that they were not, you know, going to just, it was not just going to be business as usual. They weren't just going to stand Wall Street back up and let them get going again. They were going to regulate these guys. They were going to break up the big banks. You know, they were going to fire these guys. All of those things happened back then. This time around, none of it.
Well, in your conclusion to your book, Thomas Frank, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, the conclusion, Trample the Weak, you say, moneyed interest understand that with no second FDR, no incorruptible new cop on the financial beat, no return to the rules that once made banking boring but safe, they have nothing to fear from us and may do as they please. This is the real tragedy of the Great Recession.
That's right. I'm speaking about the lost opportunity there.
Yes, yes.
I mean, the fact that these people destroyed the world. They drove the economic world over a cliff, and we didn't punish them. They didn't get punished by our political system. And so why not just do it again? There's nothing to fear for them. I mean, there's nothing political to fear. The situation is totally under control. From their perspective, the only, real protest movement that you saw for three whole years after the crash happened was the Tea Party movement, which is explicitly about deregulating these guys even more and letting them do whatever they want, just as long as they don't get a bailout. Occupy Wall Street is a movement that I have a lot of hope in, and I really like what I've seen so far, but they didn't show up for 3 years. After the initial crisis.
And they have no legislative agenda. They don't want to get involved in electoral politics, unlike the Tea Party that got to, 60 to 70 members elected.
That's right. And, I mean, that's just the beginning of the sort of disparity. I mean, the Occupy Wall Street movement is just getting off the ground. They'll be lucky if they have, just one or two legislators that proudly identify with them, whereas the Tea Party movement is essentially in control, of the House of Representatives now.
So, Thomas Frank, your new book, Pity the Billionaire, gets into why the punditry got it all so wrong. And the conventional wisdom was that after George W. Bush and the disgrace of crony gangster capitalism, the left would come back and that the right would retreat and lick their wounds. And that the punditry, you say in the book, believed back in 2008 and 2009 that the right needed to moderate itself back to the center. Well, guess what? It's the Obama White House that's moved back to the center.
That's right.
And the Republicans have moved way to the right.
Exactly. And, this is something that you could see coming way back when it was starting, that the pundits were all saying, they have to, the GOP has to become moderate. They have to stop listening to people like Rush Limbaugh. They have to see that their economic program has failed and their ethical claims gave us Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff, this sort of thing. It was just like the pundits looked at this at the George W. Bush presidency. Remember how unpopular he was in the last days. And they said, this is a political movement that is in ruins. And if it's not in ruins, it ought to be in ruins. And they just sort of logically assumed that the pendulum would swing back the other way. The idea that the Republicans would do the opposite, that they would swing hard to the right and come back to us as a sort of purified, even more intense free market party, that possibility never occurred to anyone back then. And that they might be victorious by doing that. Wow. That's the thing that's just... But I have a lot of fun... pointing out how wrong the pundits were, 3 years ago, and I guess that's sort of shooting fish in a barrel, But it's one of those incidents where the conventional wisdom just completely failed. And one of the reasons why is that what the pundits didn't understand then, and I think they still don't understand today, is that they all live in Washington D.C. this sort of bipartisan world where where you've got the entire universe is defined by these two political parties. And it always seems like the course of wisdom is to move to the center. Always. If only we could just come together as a people. And the Democrats, by and large, hear that message and heed that message. And so you have guys like Barack Obama who thinks that apparently thinks that partisanship is like the worst thing afflicting our nation. Not, epidemic financial fraud, you know, or economic collapse or anything like. No, it's partisanship. That's the real problem in America. And what's always interested me is that the conservative movement, they don't care about that. They don't care about the pundits, you know, the problem of partisanship or anything like that. They want to get what they want. You know, they're out there to win, not to please the pundits. And, you know, they're not about, you know, moving to the center and holding on to their jobs or something like that. They're about getting, you know, their historical mission accomplished. And that's what they did.
Well, surely, though, Thomas Frank, they've been helped, the Conservatives have been helped immensely by the Citizens United decision. You can see what's happening now with these super PACs. Now, admittedly, they're beating up Gingrich and other Conservatives have been the victims of it. But it's there's no question that it's helped, and it certainly helped in 2010.
Yeah, and it's completely changed the way elections are being done. You know, the job that Romney's backers did on Newt Gingrich in Iowa it's really amazing. It was just, they just dumped money on this guy. They just smothered him with money. And it's also very amusing the way Newt Gingrich is fighting back now. He's running these TV commercials. I don't know if you've seen them, but they're like to the left of anything I've ever heard from Democrats in my lifetime, or they seem to be. I mean, he has a kind of, but technically he has nothing to do with it, right?
It's a billionaire friend who's put up some money. One billionaire. That's the point about Citizens United. You know.
Exactly. No, money is so much more important. And it's also funny that, we think of ourselves as we're a nation of individualists. We're a nation of people who think for ourselves. You know, and we go out there and we make our decisions based on what we see with our own eyes. But then you look at it, and the money translates directly into votes, you know, more or less. I mean, there's lots of examples where that hasn't worked out, you know. But that's sort of what's been going on in these Republican primaries. And by the way, the role of money in the Tea Party movement is not negligible. You know, money played a huge role in getting this thing off the ground. Things that got me interested in this is I went to what I believe was the very first Tea Party rally, although they, of course, argue about that among themselves, who was first, you know. But it was in February of 2009 in the park across the street from the White House. And it was largely a product of the sort of your traditional Washington, D.C. conservative establishment, you know. Newt Gingrich's group was out there. Dick Armey's group was out there. A couple of other libertarian groups were out there. Grover Norquist's group had some presence there. And then a bunch of sort of conservative movement celebrities were taking turns speaking through a bullhorn. And that was it. That was the beginning. And it took off from there, which is just extraordinary, you know.
Right. Well, we missed the interview that we were going to do about try and answer the question of what is Obama going to do about the enormous vote he got from the young and the anti-war Democrats in 2008, which seems to be being captured now by Ron Paul. I guess that's a discussion for another day. You can only scratch your head at the fecklessness of the Democrats. But
oh my God, I try to get into that topic in Pity the Billionaire, but you're exactly right. It's just, I mean, I just wonder at that, you know,
right.
How do they manage to screw it up again and again and again?
But do you think, though, Thomas Frank, that there's a psychological component here to what's happening to America? It sort of reminds me of a political version of the Stockholm syndrome, where you begin to identify with your torturer, that the power of the right, the Republicans, unleashed by Citizens United, domination of the media is such that it seems to be that they've literally beaten the American people into submission.
Yeah, I think there's something like that going on. I think that's about right. I don't know if I would. I'm not sure which syndrome I would go with, though. But it is definitely the case that people believe or seem to believe in a kind of hallucinatory, make-believe world, imaginary world that is more convincing and more real to them than everyday experience, than what they actually see in the newspapers. I'll give you an example from yesterday's Wall Street Journal. Had a big interview with Rick Santorum, very interesting interview. The headline on it was, Supply Cider for the Working Man. You know, is there such a thing? Can there even be such a thing? Mm. You know, and how does the working man have any interest in supply side politics or supply side economics? It boggles the mind. But I'm very interested in that subject as well. And there's a whole chapter of Pity the Billionaire about the kind of psychological retreat that people do nowadays, where they are able to wall themselves off from the world. They watch Fox News. They read, you know, certain websites and not others. They don't read a general interest newspaper. They live in a neighborhood filled with people just like themselves. And they, what really intrigues me is that they believe in a kind of utopianism, a utopian worldview, which you didn't see just 5 or 6 years ago would have been seems very strange, but today is everywhere. And the utopianism, of course, is free market. You know, if we just can reach some kind of Ayn Rand world where where government is completely out of the picture, you know, it will be this sort of utopia.
Well, that suggests that Mitt Romney's got a good chance. And you warn here at the end of your book, Thomas Frank, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, that it could be a new, more ideologically concentrated right that gets their hands on the rest of the machinery of government. In other words, what we've seen with the Congress and their scorched earth tactics, if they take over completely, to my mind, it's the end of anything that resembles an American left. Of course, once again, the progressives and liberals are deluding themselves that Obama's got a shoe-in. You know, they woke up one day and Ronald Reagan was president. They woke up another day, George W. Bush was president. We could wake up in November and Mitt Romney could be president.
I wouldn't count him out. I mean, he seems kind of bumbling and silly at the moment, but you know, there's a long time between now and November. I mean, the other ones seem even more preposterous, right? I mean, President Santorum, President Gingrich, it seems impossible.
But President Perry, I mean, he's a guy who
we should
reinvade Iraq, and that. Urinating on dead Taliban is something that he's defending now.
Oh, I mean, he's standing up for that, is he?
Yes.
Oh, my God. That guy is just a nonstop laugh riot. Mitt Romney is very polished. He makes a really good presentation. You know, I would not count him out in November. It seems like it's not a good idea to do that, especially since this movement has discovered that they can, you know, speak to the hard times anger that's out there in the land. That's the most critical development here. I mean, all my life, my leftist friends assumed that if you ever had some kind of replay of the Great Depression, you would have this sort of instant return to 1930s-style politics. And you did in a sort of superficial way in the last couple of years. This, you know, the Tea Party movement looks and sounds like a hard times protest movement. But everything, all the politics of it have been turned completely upside down. So you have, you know, and in the book I make a lot of noise about, you know, one of my favorite comparisons, that these guys with their laissez-faire utopia are very similar in a lot of ways to 1930s era Communist Party members. You know, they had their utopia.
Sure.
And they claimed to speak for the producer class and had this vision of grand strikes, changing the world, like in Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, you know.
Well, but, Thomas, just in the last minute, do you think that a one percenter could be elected in spite of the 99% movement that the Occupy has done? I mean,
he could if you never made an issue out of that.
Right.
You know? But that's up to the Democrats. We'll see if they can do it.
Well, it does seem extraordinary that your book indicates how successful they've been so far. And again, the Koch brothers captured the Tea Party. There's no reason why they're one percenters, so they can do it writ large, surely.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, you need to pity Mitt Romney. They're doing such mean things about him. You know,
right.
Pity the billionaire.
Well, on that note, I thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Frank, the author of the new book, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle of the and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. He's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal and the founding editor of The Baffler and a monthly columnist for Harper's. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Mark Perry, who has an article at Foreign Policy False Flag, which reveals how Mossad agents posed as CIA officers to recruit terrorists who killed Iranian soldiers and civilians. This is just a small part of a bigger picture, which we really went into in depth about frictions between the U.S. and Israel, the possibility that the Republicans working with Netanyahu, who despises Obama, could cook up an incident that might help elect Romney. That is always a subtext. After all, they pushed the National Defense Authorization Act, which the Democrats signed onto because AIPAC owns both the Democrats and the Republicans on Capitol Hill. That is the precursor to what's happening now with tensions rising, the possibility of war through miscalculation. Since the Iranians feel that cutting off their revenues from oil is an act of war, this is what's happening now. The Israelis apparently tried to, by killing this Iranian scientist, they were trying to sabotage talks that were happening in Turkey between the U.S. and Iran over walking back from the brink. So it's difficult to understand exactly how far the Israelis want to push the envelope. But Mark Perry's revelations of how they posed as CIA officers in Baluchistan, the extent to which they put American lives at risk and screwed up our relationship with Pakistan, which of course is pretty bad to begin with, indicates a kind of recklessness, if not ruthlessness, that is certainly worth exploring. And of course, the long and the short of it is, it's pretty clear that Obama doesn't want a war, but he may get one in an election year. And at the very least, the price of oil will go through the ceiling. So that is the subtext. Now, the second half of the program was with Tom Frank, this wonderful writer who's written this new book, Pity the Billionaires, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. We had a very interesting conversation. I mean, the book is so beautifully written. He's a really fine writer. It's a very important book in the sense to explain this and how come the right captured the outrage over what Wall Street did in 2000 left, and the left has been sitting around, can't even get their narrative together, except for the Occupy movement that doesn't want to translate its activities into politics in any case. So I think it's a primer and an important book that everybody should read. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. Where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.